This is the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Hello there. This is the 32nd episode of the Urban Astronomer Podcast, and we are back on form with long interviews with interesting scientists. I'm sorry that it's taken so long to get this episode out there, especially since the interview was actually recorded many weeks ago, but I've had some family crises to deal with and that we are also trying to get through. My grandmother recently fell very ill, seriously enough that the family was summoned to her bedside so that she wouldn't die alone. So I've been out of town making daily hospital visits for a while now, and funeral plans and what have you, and it's been hard to carry on as normal. But on the other hand, sometimes I need a dose of normality just to be able to keep carrying on, so I found a few hours alone to put this episode together. Hopefully, it meets with the usual standard. Anyway, this episode features an interview with Dr. Nicole Gallucci. Dr. Gallucci is an assistant professor of astrophysics at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, USA. If you are a regular listener of the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast, where older episodes of Urban Astronomer are syndicated, then you'll already know her voice, as she has appeared in many Hangouts, podcasts, and videos while working with CosmoQuest and Universe Today. She has a South African connection too, having spent some time building the Paper Radio Telescope Array in the Karoo as part of her PhD research. She very kindly agreed to appear on the show, and here she is.
Yeah, hi. So I'm Dr. Nicole Gallucci. I am currently a professor at the Department of Physics at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. My background is in radio astronomy and also in science education and outreach. So I'm originally from New York, Staten Island, New York, which is why we joked about the title Urban Astronomer, since I grew up in a very, very light polluted section of the United States, which led to some major failures at trying to actually be an amateur astronomer. So I really didn't actually learn how to use an optical telescope until grad school, sadly, when I was in Virginia, and it was a little bit less light polluted. I sometimes joke that I do radio astronomy because I was so terrible at optical astronomy because I grew up in New York City. The real reason I do radio astronomy is I got an internship when I was an undergrad at a radio observatory in Massachusetts, MIT Haystack Observatory, which is now only 40 minutes from where I live currently. So I kind of come in a little circle from how I started doing radio astronomy.
Okay, great. So then what was your interest? I mean, was this something you grew into while studying, or were you always interested in space and astronomy? How did you get into it?
Yeah, I was always interested in science. From when I was super, super little kid, I loved science. I asked why all the time. And my mother didn't have Google to refer me to back then, so she took me to the library and made me take out science books. So I was super into science from a very young age. I wanted to be an astronaut when I was 5. And I think they got me a little telescope so I could see the moon, which is about all you could see when you're 5 and living in Staten Island, New York. And somebody along, somebody told 5-year-old me that, if you want to be an astronaut, you have to be a scientist first. So I'm like, okay, I'll be an astronomer. I kind of actually bounced around a little bit. Like, for a while, I was super into botany. And for a while, I was into a bunch of different other, I had a microscope and I loved looking at things in my microscope. So I bounced around a bit science-wise until I was about 12 or 13. One of the couple things happened that were my turning point around the same time, and one of them was the Pathfinder lander and Sojourner rover on Mars. That was in 1997, so I was about 13. That was going on, and it was our first successful landing on Mars in however many years, and so it was in the news, and I was super glued to that. And also I saw the movie Contact, based on the Carl Sagan novel, starring Jodie Foster as a radio astronomer who's looking for signals of extraterrestrials. And I clearly remember seeing this scene of, like, her as a little kid, her character, Ellie Arroway, as a little kid looking at the stars, watching, like, a meteor shower and deciding she wanted to be an astronomer, and then, like, growing up to be an astronomer. And that impacted me so much. I was like, oh, she grew up to be an astronomer. Even though it was fiction, I was like, I can do that too. So these days when we talk more about having diversity on screen, like playing scientists or, you know, superheroes, even all kinds of things, like, it is so important to see someone that looks like you in that role, even if it's fictional, because that was a big thing. And that is, it just so happened that I ended up doing radio astronomy and working at one of the same observatories that's in that movie, and, you know, taking the iconic picture with the headphones on my head, like from the movie. All just sort of happened to work out that way. I went to school thinking I'm going to be an astronomer because of that movie, in large part. And I had a physics teacher, Ms. Sadowski, who is still teaching in New York City, who encouraged me to stick with it and major in physics when I went to college and all of that. So, yeah, I pretty much set my mind to it kind of early, not even knowing at all what I was getting into, which is the weird part. It's led me down some interesting paths, doing some really cool stuff.
Brilliant. Man, I wish I had such a clear view of what I wanted to do when I was little, you know, because I think I started the same. You know, interested in science and interested in astronauts and what have you. But I was bouncing around from dinosaurs to volcanoes to...
Oh, yeah.
I think almost textbook, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
electronics at one point, yeah.
When I was in college, I went to a little liberal arts school in Pennsylvania called Lycoming College. And one of my professors, Dr. Fisher, who's still there teaching, he did a freshman orientation type class. It was like kind of a general topic class. Like, I took one in utopian literature because why not? It's college. Do something fun. He gave one that I was a TA for. It was called Rockets and Dinosaurs. It's like all the stuff you liked when you were like 6 to 12. We're going to talk about that. So we talked about rockets and we talked about dinosaurs. And it was super fun because it was just like being little kids again. So that was like the science course that a bunch of people took at that college.
But wow, utopian literature, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I did that as a freshman, and I dressed up as Plato for our presentation. it was a strange time.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
So once you'd, I don't know what your career progression was. So let's just say, for the sake of the discussion, you can correct me. Once you'd graduated, what was your research interest? I mean, what were you actually using the radio astronomy for?
Yeah, so I started in undergrad doing these research experience for undergraduates, which are programs that are popular around the U.S. for students to get some research experience as an undergraduate. And it's especially useful for people like me who are at a small college where you don't have a whole lot of research experiences open to you to, like, check out something bigger or go to something else, you know, go somewhere else and do research there. So after doing that, I had done one summer at MIT Haystack, and then my advisor from that project introduced me to one of her colleagues who worked at the time at the Very Large Array in New Mexico. So I applied to work with him the next summer, and I got that, and so I worked with him for two summers. So I've been working for the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is the major radio astronomy observatory in the U.S., out in New Mexico for two summers. And that, since I had been really enjoying that, I was like, I want to do radio astronomy for grad school. But I wasn't quite ready to move that far west. So I applied to, among other places, I applied to the University of Virginia, which is on the East Coast. So it's like 7-hour drive from New York City, where my family was. And that's where the headquarters for the National Radio Astronomy Observatory is. And they also have an observatory in back up. They had an observatory in West Virginia. The observatory is still there, but it's now not managed by the NRAO. It's a slightly separate thing, but it's all the same cool people. It's the Green Bank Telescope, so it's the largest fully steerable radio telescope in the world. The largest one that can be moved, not like Arecibo, which is fixed. So I got in there and started working. I worked on one project which used the Green Bank Telescope with Jim Bratz, an astronomer out there who is super awesome, and was looking at I was just kind of like interested in the process. I didn't have anyone, and I still actually to this day don't have any one astronomical scientific question that I was like, I must understand this. You know, a lot of astronomers are like, I really want to understand galaxy formation, or I really want to understand black hole dynamics. For me, I think I was drawn to the process of collecting and analyzing data itself. So I ended up doing a focus on instrumentation in radio astronomy, so building radio telescopes. So I've done a little bit of supermassive black holes, and I've done a little bit of mega masers also around black holes. And then when I joined a project, which is my connection to South Africa, which is PAPER, the Precision Array to Probe the Epoch of Reionization. That's the project I ended up joining and doing my PhD dissertation on. So we were designing and building an array of radio telescopes to look for the signal of neutral hydrogen that was around between galaxies during the first epoch of galaxy formation. And to get some information about that first epoch of galaxy formation. And to do that, you have to build a very sensitive instrument, which we prototyped in Green Bank. So I spent a lot of time driving out to West Virginia and working on the prototype there. But we needed a much more radio quiet site. So just like how I can't do optical astronomy from Staten Island, and I say that facetiously because there are some amazing amateur astronomers who do stuff from New York City, because there is some stuff you can see. There are planets, there are bright stars. But as a 12-year-old, I couldn't figure that out myself. But to do, you know, to do research, to get down to the really faint stuff, you have to leave a city and go out to the desert where there's no lights. Same thing with radio telescopes. You have to get away from all the Wi-Fi signals and the Bluetooth and, you know, all the cell phones and even things like electric, you know, anything that runs on electricity is giving off radio waves. Car spark plugs are famous for doing it. Microwave ovens, like the list is endless. You have to get as far away from people. Microwave ovens are great. the one in Green Bank, there's a microwave that the astronomers can use, but it's built into a large metal box. So you have to like close the microwave and then close the metal box to use it. It's very strange. Anyway, so the site that PAPER was eventually built at, and I was involved in some of that building, was in the Karoo in South Africa. The site which had an amazing first light, first light image, or first, I don't know, first fringes, first light, whatever. They published a gorgeous image from Meerkat. At the time I was there, so it was like 2011, there were 7 prototype dishes out there. So this was pre-Meerkat, during Cat 7. We built out, I was out there building part of the PAPER array. And I graduated in 2012 and moved on to different work. But that project continued and is now part of a larger effort called HERA, where they're building even larger antennas out in the Karoo to look for the hydrogen epoch of reionization signal.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereabouts in the Karoo was it? Do you know what town it was by? Or?
Oh, my gosh. I do not remember at all. All I know is it's exactly where Meerkat is right now. So,
that is the same place where they're building SKA, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes, it's the SKA site.
So Carnarvon then.
Yeah. Yes. Carnarvon,
or however you pronounce it. Yeah. Okay.
It was.
Okay.
Yeah. We. I mean, it was still under development. In terms of utilities. Like, we didn't have a power line running to our array. We had a little, we had diesel power for the electricity. So we had to fill the little diesel tank whenever we wanted to use the telescope. And the dorms weren't finished. There weren't a whole lot of dorms yet, and they had people in them. So we were in trailers that they had converted into dorms, which was actually kind of cozy. So we were there in winter, and that was the year I didn't have a summer solstice because I flew down in July on the solstice. Okay. So I missed the summer solstice completely. I had two winter solstices in 1 year. But it wasn't, it's only at a latitude of negative 20 something, right? It's not super cold in the winter. I had like a little space heater and a little electric blanket in my trailer dorm, and that was fine. But it was a little bit like, camping. Not quite, more like glamping, I guess, because we did have, you know, running water and all that stuff.
What time of year was it?
It was July. It was about two and a half weeks in July. I was out at the Karoo site, and I was in Cape Town for a few days before and after. So I didn't get to do a whole lot in Cape Town. I had like one day to run around and be like a tourist. And I've wanted to go back ever since. I just haven't been able to make it line up with any. Usually when I travel, it's for work because I don't have a whole lot of money to go running around the world and doing fun stuff like that, or time. So I try and line them up with work trips, and I haven't had any work trip line up with Cape Town again, sadly. But I'd love to come back because, you know, we saw so much at the Karoo site, but that was, you know, I didn't get to see so much of everything in between.
That's a pity.
Yeah, but it was such a difference in the data quality, because the middle of nowhere West Virginia feels like the middle of nowhere, but it's not. You have emergency bands, like the ambulances and police departments use the frequencies in that band. You have all the electronics that are on site from the other telescopes. You have, all the just static electricity from people walking around. I mean, it's just amazing how, you know, quote unquote loud it is. Okay. Compared to the Karoo, the only things we saw were our own electronics. Okay, you know, but we shielded that. And satellites. Like, the rest of the band was clean and perfect and empty. It was just, like, such a difference.
Because that whole area is a protected area now, in terms of electromagnetic, you know, and radio transmissions and so on. I think they're not even allowed to have TV transmissions in there.
That sounds about right. Yeah, and technically we have that in West Virginia, but it's a very small area, and it's a very old statute. There's been a lot of, you know, built up since then, but I think. Down at the SKA site, they're protecting that very, very strictly for that reason, just to keep that as pristine as possible.
We've actually got activist groups campaigning to get the whole thing stopped because they want their TV and they want their they don't want all their infrastructure being built. And
yeah, that's a difficult and that's a really difficult issue, right? How do you balance the needs of people already living there with this goal for this cool scientific project? That's a serious issue that you have to work with.
I find the arguments interesting. To me, just reading it, not living there, it seems like about two-thirds of their arguments are just utter nonsense. You know, they're just coming up with whatever they can to pad it. But the rest of them are quite serious. These are real concerns, and you realize, wow, this is actually a bit of a problem that they're creating here. What do you do?
I don't know quite how to deal with that. I know that that's a problem that we as a, you know, astronomical scientific community are dealing with in a lot of spaces, is that there's this history of encroaching on a space where people have lived and deciding this is our dark space or this is our radio quiet zone, without respecting the people that are already there, which is a serious concern, because you can't just kick people off their land and be like, we have to do science now. So there needs to be a lot of discussion and respect. And unfortunately, I'm so far out of that project now that I don't know the status of where they are on that. And for Green Bank, it was, I don't know what the story was, but that was put in place 50, 60 years ago. And the population grew around it despite that. So they still have to have these discussions with local governments on how strictly they enforce the bans and out to what radius and things like that. Yeah. What we could do, we could just build all our telescopes on the moon, which is crazy expensive. But at least no one lives there, right? We're not encroaching on anyone's, living space there. But that's a bit more radical, I think, than we're ready for.
That's a future we can dream for, yeah.
Yes. Antarctica, I guess. There's no humans living in Antarctica. That's also really hard to get to.
Well, you still got plenty of satellites, and there's the South Pole base or whatever it's called. I don't know the name.
Yep. I've never been.
Scattered around on the coast. Yeah.
But I mean, other than the penguins, you know, as long as you're not bothering the penguins, it's a whole different story. Yeah.
You managed to, on your own, cover every single question I had lined up.
I'm not even done though. That's just like one half of my research life.
Oh well, please keep going. Sure. I'm interested.
I didn't want to like ramble too much, so please interject or interrupt me wherever. So interestingly, like I said earlier, I jumped into astronomy and decided I was going to be an astronomer, and I had no idea what being an astronomer entails. And I liked astronomy, but I discovered through grad school that I liked teaching about astronomy even more. So I did my dissertation in this radio astronomy work, but I ended up getting a job after grad school with Pamela Gay at CosmoQuest, which was more of an education or science education and outreach position. So that's where I met you, like you said, or internet met you, I guess, or Skyped you before, because what I did was a lot of the public outreach stuff for the Citizen Science Project CosmoQuest. So CosmoQuest has nothing to do with radio astronomy. It's there's a lot of planetary science. So we're getting citizen scientists to help characterize the surfaces of the moon, of asteroid Vesta, of I think Mars was added after I left, Mercury.
Yes, yeah.
So you're getting humans, people who are interested in science, helping to do the research, not just people who were crazy enough to slog through X years of grad school, like some of us. I was doing more of the public outreach face of that. I was developing lesson plans for middle school teachers to use alongside that. And I was doing research into what, so this is my first foray into education research, where it's like, what makes people want to volunteer their time to do this project with us? We are looking at that as looking at a group of people who do the citizen science and say, why are you doing that? And this is actually a fairly active topic of research, because we want to understand what gets people interested in citizen science, what gets them interested in trying it, and what gets them interested in sticking with it. Because sometimes it is a pretty repetitive task. And there are so many citizen science projects out there who are looking at ways of engaging their audiences better, and looking at ways of getting people involved in their research better. So I did that, and I'm still kind of finishing up that work in education. And when postdoc is typically around a 2 or 3 year like limited time frame. So I started looking at teaching positions after that, because some of my time spent at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, near the end in particular, I was also teaching. I was teaching some intro physics labs, but I was also teaching science to elementary education majors. So the students who were studying to become the next generation of kindergarten through fifth grade teachers, teaching them all the science they need to know. So that was a really interesting experience working on that, because they had developed a curriculum there that was all hands-on. and like experiential. And so you're not so much trying to memorize this ridiculous list of facts as you are getting them to do the same kind of experiments that they'd have their students do with the same type of material. So like cheap stuff that they can get access to as a teacher. In particular, they have a resource center there that local teachers can use. So we used all the stuff from the resource center that they could borrow when they go on to their career. And so that, interestingly enough, got me on the radar for this job at St. Anselm College, because the position was, so I was applied to like all of these teaching positions all over the U.S. and some outside the U.S. I just went nuts with this huge list of applications because I was like, I need a job. Funding's running out. I like to teach. Here are all the jobs that involve teaching. And St. A's came up, and one of my supervisor at the STEM Center was like, you would be really good for this position. And I'm like, nah, it doesn't look, I don't think. She's like, no, you'll be good for this position. You should apply. So, you know, tip for all you listening out there, if there's a job that you're not sure if you're qualified for, apply anyway. Surprise. They may surprise you and pick you as their first choice. So I applied for this job because it was a position in the physics department, but it was also backed by the education department because they were specifically looking for someone who could teach physics to undergrads, do research with undergrads, and also teach education majors the science they need to know to go out and teach kindergarten through fifth grade science. And that's what I was getting, you know, experience in. So I ended up, and someone who would also be doing science education research. So the stuff I started doing with CosmoQuest was what they were looking for. Right. So I went on a bunch of interviews, and St. A's was my favorite for several reasons. One is the campus was a lot like the place where I went to school as an undergrad. So it felt very familiar in that it was a small liberal arts school. Everybody there was super awesome. It was a really great opportunity as a tenure track professorship. And location-wise, it was back on this side of the country where my family lives, or at least my mom lives now.
That's nice, yeah.
My brothers have gone off and scattered now. So for a lot of, and my partner's family lives here too. So he is somewhere in the mix. My partner moved in with me and he got dragged from Philly out to Illinois, and then from Illinois got dragged to New Hampshire, and he's just been following my ridiculousness, which I'm super grateful for. So I ended up getting offered that position and taking it immediately because I was super excited about it. So they don't have joint appointments. I'm just appointed by the physics department, but I have a close relationship with the education department too. And they're all super awesome. So what I'm doing now is I'm teaching a lot. I teach three classes a semester. Usually one of those classes is a lab, which for some reason takes me 20 times as long to grade as anything else that I do. I don't know why grading labs takes so long. But I'm, you know, every semester, it's funny, the dean asked me recently, you know, what teaching goals, you know, I know what your research goals are, but what are your teaching goals? I'm like, oh, I have no shortage of those. Every semester, I'm either teaching a course that's new to me, or I'm redesigning the course because I didn't like how it went last time, or, you know, just something bizarre like that. So I've been teaching intro astronomy. I'm teaching an online course for St. Anselm right now in intro astronomy. I created a astronomy minor, and I'm the first astronomer there. Yay! Although the other physics professors like astronomy too, so they would teach it occasionally, but they didn't have someone who actually had like a full graduate school background in it. So I'm creating these other courses. I'm going to have an astrophysics course. I'm going to be creating, and then I teach our physics majors, our physics classes. Like I'm doing modern physics next semester, which is super fun because this is when you get to teach them relativity, when everything gets really weird and quantum physics when everything gets even weirder. So we're taking them out of intro physics, where everything is nice and makes sense and is classical and has Newton's laws and circuit laws. Now I'm throwing them into quantum and relativity. So
modern physics was my least favorite, so I gotta say.
Really? Oh, I loved it. I still don't understand.
Conceptually,
it
I loved it.
Yes.
You know, it was so interesting, but somehow maths was never my strong point, you know, and that is so maths, right?
Yes. I used to be really good at math. I got a math minor in college. Nowadays, I look at it and I'm like, how did I do that? Because I didn't do as much when I went into doing research full time. I had to learn how to code, and I'm still a terrible coder. But the computer would do all the math for me. So I haven't done the math in so long. I do teach a more conceptual, probably a little bit lean more towards the conceptual basis than a mathematical basis than some of my colleagues, which is good because who teaches quantum is much better at math than me. So they get it from both sides.
Yeah, but I agree with that. I mean, that's the most interesting side, I think. That's where things get really cool and a bit weird.
Yeah, you have to know how to do the math. But for me, at least, it's not going to cement in my brain unless I have a conceptual idea of it. So
right.
I do spend a lot of time building up the conceptual idea because that, for a lot of people, is where you remember it better and can explain it better and can intuit the solution, you know, how to even begin. Because, you know, the math is the tool that you need at some point. But in order to even know which way to go, you have to conceptually think about the problem before you pick which tools you're going to use. So, you know, that's kind of how I approach it.
Having said this, can I ambush you with a physics question?
Sure. And I have no idea if I can answer it, but I can try.
Well, I was, I did a podcast episode a few weeks ago where I was talking about stellar evolution and what's happening inside the sun. Mm-hmm. And as I was writing it, I was scripting it, I was putting together, talking about the different zones. You've got the core and the radiative zone and the convective zone and so on. And I hate to just say, this is what happens. I want to say why it happens. And I realize I have no idea why there is no convection in the radiative zone.
Why there is no convection in the radiative zone. Oh my God, I did this in grad school. So, yes, there are... Oh my God, I'm reaching deep into my brain. Into 2006 when I took this course.
That's fine. This is raw and this is unscripted, so...
Yeah. So there is a way... Oh my God, this is so bad. This is so not what I'm an expert at, even remotely. But I clearly remember learning about this in my stellar astrophysics class in graduate school.
Can I tell you what I picked up?
Yes,
This wasn't really my area either. Yeah. My understanding was, and I might be... I'm not sure if these are both factors or if one is right and one is wrong, but as I recall, on the one hand, it's a very, very high pressure, very high density region. So I don't know if viscosity is the right word to use when you're talking about a plasma, but very high viscosity, so it doesn't want to move very much. And secondly, radiative transfer is much more efficient, so that by the time any kind of motion could start, the temperature is already equalized locally.
Right. Basically, basically, that's it. The physical conditions, the density, the pressure, the temperature are all such that and I just remember doing these calculations, but I can't remember what they're called, which is why I'm struggling. Under the set of conditions closer in, radiation is more effective than convection. And under the conditions further out, convection is more effective than radiation. So the one that's more effective under those physical conditions takes over. And I know there's this whole set of calculations where you can prove that, and I don't remember what any of that is called, but I know I did it at one point in my life. So you basically have it. It's which one is more efficient under the given conditions. And that's the basics of stellar astrophysics is given a certain set of conditions, what's going to happen?
Oh, I'm so glad you said that because I wasn't sure. You know, I'd ended up having to do just quickly research it, and you know how it is when you feel you understand it, but you're not prepared to commit it in writing or to a microphone. Well, now I can. Thank you.
That is how I feel about a lot of what I teach sometimes, to be honest. There's this great book called Teaching What You Don't Know, and I forget who the author is. I have it on my Kindle somewhere. It's all about how to teach subjects where you aren't an expert in it. And I run into this when I teach Life Beyond Earth, which is kind of a introduction to astrobiology course, because there's a lot of sections in that, the chemistry and the biology, that I'm not an expert in. And some of my students are bio majors, and they do know these things better than me. And so how you work that out as a dialogue in the classroom is a little bit about what that book is about, and how to speak on things with some, you know, the level of confidence that you do have. When I talk at sci-fi conventions, like I'm going to Dragon Con at the end of August again, I will find myself talking about things that I am in no way an expert on, but I will say, here's the level of knowledge I have. It might be slightly more than you, maybe slightly, you know, I'm not the expert. So if you find something down the line that contradicts it, you know, that's cool. That this is where I am in my understanding of it. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. Yeah.
Well, I have a bad habit of just speaking way outside my knowledge. You know, you're in a position, you're expected to be the... Well, I worked in tech support for so many years, and half of it is just coming up with persuasive ways to get people to check that it is in fact switched on without making them, without implying that you're calling them an idiot. You know,
did you turn it off and turn it on again? Yes.
Right. You think I didn't try that? No, of course not. I don't think, you know, but a lot of it was just cultivating that air of authority. That's a dangerous trap.
You
end up saying the biggest nonsense.
Yeah. I think what I try and do, and this is something I've struggled with, because I struggle with, and if you've heard of imposter syndrome, it's not like a real diagnosis, but it's like when you feel like you're supposed to be an expert in something, or you're supposed to be good at something, you feel like, I got this far, but I don't deserve to be here, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so I struggle to balance imposter syndrome with, I am the authority in the classroom, I should know what's going on, with a third thing, which is, I strongly believe that I can't really teach anybody anything. I can help them learn it, but I can't transfer knowledge from my brain to them. So how, you know, I believe the learning process is really that two-way exchange. So I've somehow cultivated, I think, this classroom community, I guess, or you know, where the students do see me, they call me doctor, they call me professor, they know I'm, you know, the quote-unquote expert in the field, but I make it very clear to them where the ends of my knowledge are. You know, and I've had to be comfortable with saying, yeah, I don't really know, let's look at this together, and being afraid of losing their respect. And maybe this just speaks to the students that I have, how amazing they are, but I feel like I haven't lost their respect anytime I've done that. It's like, I don't really know, let's look this up together. Seems to work really well with the students I've been working with the last 3 years at this college in particular, because they've seemed to be a little more open with me about, I don't really understand this, can we talk about it? I think it opens it up a little bit more, that they're willing to come to me when they're stuck rather than beat their head against a brick wall trying to finish a homework assignment, because they know I'm out here saying, yeah, I don't know, I gotta look this up too. I don't have any, you know, this is all anecdotal, I haven't like studied this, but that's kind of something that's gone into my teaching philosophy and how I've tried to build a classroom community. Like, I could ramble about astronomy facts all day long. I could talk about astronomy for hours and hours and hours and hours. And they might even be entertained, but I don't think they're going to learn anything. So I've been shifting my classes away from lectures and more towards worksheets and discussions and collaborative assignments. So I'm, you know, and the feedback I get, some is positive, some is negative. Some people just want me to lecture, and I'm like, I'm not going to do that. The education research says most people do not learn that way, so I'm not going to do that. As much as I would love to talk about astronomy for hours, you're not going to get anything out of it. So my teaching has gone more towards this collaborative model, which makes it really weird when I actually give a talk somewhere like at Dragon Con, and I'm like, I'm not used to giving talks anymore for like a whole hour. I don't do that. I try and make my Dragon Con stuff a little bit more interactive if I'm the only one, and it doesn't always work out that way because they're looking at me like, this isn't normal. This isn't what we do.
Yeah.
But it's fun anyway. I'll get people to like raise their hands and vote on stuff, so that's always fun. I think I've gone completely off in some tangent, and I don't know where I am or where we started, and I apologize for that.
So what are you working on now? What's interesting? What are you doing?
Yeah,
now?
So right now I've got a whole bunch of things going in addition to my classwork. Now that I'm a little bit more settled in teaching, I've been able to devote more time to research, and I have to. I'm on the tenure track, right? I have to get stuff out there, get stuff done. One big thing is the motivations of our CosmoQuest citizen scientists. That paper is getting finished up slowly but surely. So we'll be putting that out. All the work is done. We're just finishing the writing of it. And I'm starting a project. I'm super excited. My colleague, who's an education faculty at St. Anselm, Kelly Demers, just on the phone with her before this call with you. We got a grant for St. Anselm to do a project, it's called a noise capacity building project, from the National Science Foundation. What it means is we're spending a year piloting some methods of getting science majors or STEM majors, so science, technology, engineering, mathematics majors, to also consider secondary education, adding that to their education, so adding on high school teaching as a possible career path. So we got some money to do that, and the keystone piece of that is we're developing some after-school. There's already an after-school program that's run out of our college called Access Academy. They bus the kids in from the local high schools and do these fun hands-on topics. They have money to do a bunch of humanities-related classes, which were really cool and really popular. And the students, the high school students they focus on are Manchester, New Hampshire is a big refugee resettlement site in the U.S. So it focuses on refugee, immigrant, and other underserved populations, which is really, really important right now and always, I think. And so we're giving these students a chance to get some high school credit, do something completely different from what they do in class all day, and also check out a college campus, like the local college. And we've had several students who chose St. A's to go for undergrad as a result of this program. But they don't have a whole lot of STEM offerings. And so we're building in a few STEM offerings, and they're going to be taught by college students. So they'll be taught by a combination of science and education majors so that the science majors can get a look into what education is like and what it might be like to actually be a high school teacher, the kind of students that they'd be working with. So we're developing this program to try and convince some more STEM majors to try out teaching, because quite a few of them actually find out after they've graduated, hey, I want to try teaching high school. And then they have to go through all the certification stuff after they've graduated. So we're trying to catch them earlier. Give them that opportunity earlier to get into high school teaching and do that as part of their time in college. And even if they don't, I think it's super important for all people in STEM to try doing education and outreach, because for me, I found out I had a talent and a love for it. And that's what my career focuses on now. And even if you do more focus on research and end up working, you know, for a national lab, there's still opportunities for you to build education and outreach into your work. And so it's a good way to practice those skills and see if you like it and see if you're good at it. So I'm a big advocate of this, and I'm just over the moon excited when we got the money, and also slightly terrified because now I'm a co-PI on a major grant. And I have, So we're getting that started this year. So we're going to, you know, try out this method. We actually have Georgia Bracey, who has also worked with CosmoQuest with me. She's going to be our evaluator for the project. So we kept my SIUE ties and the CosmoQuest ties in there, recruiting Georgia. So she's going to be helping us out. So that's going to be my focus for the next year. That, and also, I'm going to try and get some funding to support either a summer student or work it out some, I don't know, it's hard to pay students during the year when they're undergrads because they're in classes all the time. But if I could do for credit internship or summer students, get some more students doing radio astronomy, either with some of the VLA data that I have and that my colleague here has, I'm going to reach back out to the Haystack Observatory since they're so close, and I know some folks there, getting students introduced to radio astronomy. So that's my other thing is, like, I still love radio astronomy, but my focus now is helping my undergraduate students understand it because that was such a gateway for me getting into astronomy. So that would be a nice way to, again, kind of my career come full circle and have more undergraduates doing
that.
Research.
Yeah, I've got a question for you about that. How much of an... radio astronomy is as much about the instrumentation as the actual as actual science, right? So how much of an electronics background is
Sometimes.
Useful?
So... if you're going to do it, so I have no formal electronics background, but my thesis advisor, Rich Bradley, was an electrical engineer, not an astronomer. I actually, what I needed, I kind of picked up as I went on that project. The radio astronomy is changing. The more that they're building bigger observatories, the more accessible the data is going to be to people in astronomy who don't have a radio astronomy background. So ALMA in Chile and these SKA pathfinders like Meerkat and the SKA itself, I think they're moving towards a model where the data will be already more easily accessible by any astronomer who wants to include radio data in their science question. So if they care about galaxy evolution, they're an expert in galaxy evolution, they don't necessarily need to know the details of the instrumentation of the telescope they're using.
So it's going to be already reduced, sort of like using survey data or something.
Right, exactly. Already reduced, or not that much more left to do to it. Another project I'm peripherally involved in is the Very Large Array Sky Survey, which is surveying the sky with the upgraded Very Large Array. And there will be data products of different types. There'll be raw data, but then there'll also be, already cleaned image data that people can use at different levels. So to use radio astronomy data, you don't necessarily need to have that kind of background. If you are interested in developing and building and working at these observatories, then you do need more of a background. Like I said, I didn't quite have a formal background in it, and it turned out I was really, really terrible at building things. So after I destroyed a few circuit boards, they didn't let me solder anymore. They didn't let me do any of the precision soldering anymore.
Right.
But I could, I could do big. Let me tell you, I wanted to write an entire chapter on rolling cable in the desert, because that's what I did in the crew for like 3 days straight. Was roll out cable, coax, and connect coax to the telescope to the I spent like 3 days.
There's a whole
just doing
technique
that.
To that nobody teaches you.
Dude, I got so good at creating my own little like roller thing because we had like nothing. We had like no equipment. I made my own like roller. Anyway, I have a picture of it somewhere. It's so silly. But no, they didn't let me write a chapter about that. It was very sad. They're like, that's not science. That's just you doing stuff in the desert.
That's not science. That's engineering. Yeah.
That's engineering. It's not even precision engineering. It's super helpful. Now that I teach, I actually do have some engineering physics majors that go on to do engineering programs. I love telling them all the stories of the ridiculous things we did and tried, because that's what they are going to be looking forward to in their careers as mechanical engineers. More of that, testing and guessing and, calculating the failure of some beam of wood before you stick a spool of cable on it.
Right. Yeah.
So it's nice that even though I definitely don't have expertise in that, I got my feet wet in that. I encourage everyone to try it in grad school, at least for a little while, just to try out instrumentation if it's available to you. And you might decide you hate it and this is terrible and you don't want to do it.
You know, I raised the subject because with SKE being built here, they are SKE are employing an enormous number of graduates mm-hmm. and engineers and technicians and computer science people and so on. So I think it's definitely an area to focus on over here.
And some of the work isn't going to be glamorous, and that's typically the work that they are going to hand down to students, like, you know, rolling out cable. But you learn something interesting out of it, and I'm really, really excited about how, again, I don't have super close ties to the project anymore, but I'm really excited how the SKA is creating those opportunities in South Africa. And in Southern Africa in general, because the array is going to extend, I think, further out of South Africa. It's going to extend north a little bit.
It's even going to be on a few islands, if I understand correctly.
So this is a really exciting time for students there to kind of get involved in something as it's starting. It takes a long time for these projects to be fully realized. But once you see it in action, even if it's a decade later, it's like, wow, that was incredible that we pulled that off, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, this has been great.
Yeah. I
think we have taken up all of our time now.
Okay.
Is there anything you want to promote or
oh, boy.
Or otherwise, just if people want to talk to you,
yeah,
wanting to share some details. Yeah, okay. So how can people
reach you? I am on Twitter as Noisy Astronomer. It is somewhat a play on the fact that I did radio astronomy. So, you know, if you get your noise in your signal, that's, you know, your noisy data.
Right.
But also because I'm from New York City, and people from New York City tend to be really loud. And more than a few times in my career, I've had someone in the next office be like, will you please just stop yelling all the time? Like, I'm super loud. So the noisy kind of plays off both of those. I have a blog. I don't use it. So really, it's just on Twitter. You can say hi. I will be posting I do have a YouTube channel, which I haven't used most in years. That's where I used to do a lot of the CosmoQuest hangouts and video stuff. But I'm recording my lectures for Astronomy 101 for my students, and I'm taking great pains to make them all full of images that are Creative Commons or public domain so that I can put them on YouTube. So my Astronomy 101 videos will end up on YouTube very soon. I think I've got like the first half of them done already, so I'm going to start putting those out. But, you know, Noisy Astronomer on Twitter is probably a good place to find me and where I'm doing all that fun stuff.
That is great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was super great.
ScopeX, the largest telescope and astronomy expo in South Africa, probably all of Africa, starts in less than a month on 15 September 2018. As usual, it will be held at the Museum of Military History in Sachsenwald, Johannesburg. The museum does charge a fee to let you in, which is 40 rand for adults, 30 rand for school learners and students, and 20 rand for pensioners. Once you're in the door, you have the opportunity to buy raffle tickets for various sponsored prizes, including a Canon EOS 7D Mark II kit and one of four telescopes. ScopeX started as a place where students of the telescope making class could show off their hard work, but has grown over the years into a full-fledged science and astronomy show. We have public lectures in the auditorium, science education workshops, robotics, a planetarium, an astrophotography competition, and commercial stands where you can buy your own telescope. And of course, there will be a lawn filled with homemade telescopes that the makers would like to show off. The day ends with a star party on the museum lawn, and if you haven't looked through a telescope in a while, or if you've never had the chance, I highly recommend coming along. Astronomers are extremely warm and friendly folk who are always keen to share their hobby and let newcomers have a look. So that's September 15, starting at 9 a.m. and running into the night. I'll be there as always, and I hope to see you too. So that's everything for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and if you enjoyed the show and would like to share it with friends or family, you should direct them to www.urban-astronomer.com. They will be able to play through the archives and will find the subscribe links for whichever platform they normally use to listen to podcasts, or they can just search for Urban Astronomer on iTunes or Google Podcasts or Stitcher or pretty much any other podcast directory that you can think of. If you know of any services that don't have me listed, let me know. I'll take care of it. If you'd like to leave a rating or review on any of these platforms, that would be a great help to push me up the rankings and help new listeners to find the show. If, on the other hand, you want to offer something more concrete, you could always pledge a few dollars on my Patreon account. I don't have a huge number of patrons on there, which is fine, since my expenses are quite low. But if you'd like to join them, head on over to patreon.com/urbanastronomerpodcast, or just click the Patreon link on urban-astronomer.com. If you'd like to hear more from me besides what's on the podcast, well, I am on Twitter at uastronomer, and we have uastronomer, and we have a Facebook page at facebook.com/urbanastronomer. And if you'd like to reach out to me, ask questions, or correct mistakes, you can mail me at podcast@urban-astronomer.com, or just leave a comment on the show notes page. Next week, we'll pick up on our story of our supernova, seeing what happens when a star leaves the main sequence stage of its evolution, and we'll feature an interview with Jean-Pierre Huertet from SSVI, a European group whose name translates into English as Stars Shine for Everyone. SSVI have donated a pair of telescopes to us at Scopex to distribute to schools or outreach groups that can make good use of them. They'll be presented at Scopex next month. So until next episode, remember to look up, remember to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and I hope you have clear skies. Cheerio!